Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Okowski.
Today is December 18th, 2023. I bet I fooled you, Stash, because I knew the date.
Oh, no, you didn't. No, I thought I could see it in your eyes. I could see it. When you start on the date thing, I could tell in your eyes if you're sure or not.
Okay. Our theme today is stories from Africa and the African diaspora. And we could go on and on and on. Okay. But
but I have a question. Right away, you caused me to have a question.
Uh-oh.
Could I say I'm part of the Polish diaspora?
You could, yeah.
Okay. And that would make sense?
Yeah, sure. Would,
people would think I was crazy, but that's okay. Because, then that makes more sense to me. You know, because they're, you know, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, and I have no doubt there are Polish Americans who talk about the Polish diaspora.
Oh, good. All right.
Okay.
No, I don't know any, but it makes sense, you know, so there's got to be an Italian diaspora and certainly an Irish. Wow.
Okay, so okay. Do we need to talk about speak or?
Well, we could mention
any other
Andy
coming up. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Andy Alfred Irwin, for opening up our show. Each time we do a show with your wonderful voice and your beautiful song, Tarry Here, which invites people to come and sit and listen to the stories and to share stories. And it's so generous of him. A lot of people would have charged us. And who knows, maybe we'll get a bill in the future. Anyway, and it was great to see him last month at Adam's performance.
You know? Yeah.
And I'm glad that your husband took that wonderful picture of us.
It was a great
eight storytellers, and that's a really good collection of people there from you know, front to back,
from all over the place.
All over the place, and so many wonderful people that you and I both know.
Yeah, enrich my life for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to
stories
tell
in the round coming up not until February, but coming up, they're looking for people to buy season tickets.
You don't mean stories in the round. You mean speak.
Speak.
Yes.
Well, stories in the round are looking for people to buy.
Yeah, but that's not
too. But that's not that's not a promotional thing now. So anyway, that's up for you to tell.
Okay.
And I would mention both speak and stories in around two of my favorite activities ever in my life and two great organizations who have given me wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experiences.
Well, you have reciprocated. So thank you.
Appreciate that. So, and I'm looking forward to the new season in both of those series.
Me too. Although I am relieved to be taking a break.
From announcing.
From managing.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
So I think that you are going to start us off with a story. Is that right?
I will. And I'm going to. I mentioned that I found this wonderful book by looking into the library system. And it's put together by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Maria Tatar. And it's an annotated collection of African tales. And some are from African-American tales brought from Africa, but each one of the tales in this book, and there's hundreds of them, have references to where the tale was gotten from, what if it was from a collection, if it came from a certain country, and if possible, who was the first to tell that, if they had any information of that, or from what local community or tribe. So here we go. And this tale is from West Africa. There once lived a woman who had three sons. They were deeply attached to their mother and always tried to please her. After a time, they grew old and feeble. The boys began to wonder what they could do to make her happy. The eldest promised that he would cut a fine sepulcher in stone after her death. The second said that he would make a beautiful coffin. The youngest said, "I will go and get the tail of the princess elephant and put it in your coffin." This, by far, was the promise that was hardest to keep. Not much later, the mother died. The youngest son set out immediately on his quest without having any idea of where he would find the tail. After traveling for weeks, he reached a little village. There he met an old woman who seemed surprised to see him. She said that no human had ever been there before. The boy told her why he was searching for the princess elephant. The old woman replied that her village was the home of all the elephants and that the princess slept there every night. She warned him that the animals living there would kill him. The young man begged her to hide him, which she did, in a great pile of wood. The woman also told him that once the elephants fell asleep, he should get up and go into the far corner of the hut where he would find the princess. He should walk boldly over to her and cut off her tail. If he acted frightened in any way, the elephants would wake up and catch him. The animals returned when it was growing dark. The smell of human flesh was in the air, and they asked the old woman about it. She assured them that they were mistaken. Their supper was ready, so they ate it and went to bed. In the middle of the night, the young man got up and walked boldly across to where the princess was sleeping. He cut off her tail. He returned home with carrying the tail with great care. When daylight broke, the elephants woke up. One of them said he had dreamed about the princess's tail and how it had been stolen. The others thrashed him just for imagining such a thing. A second elephant said he had had the same dream, and he was also thrashed. The worst of all, the elephant that suggested that it might be a good idea to see if the dream was true. That was done by the wisest of all the elephants. This they did. They found the princess fast asleep, completely unaware that her tail was gone. They woke her up and sped off to find the young man. They traveled so fast that in a few hours they were able to make out the young man in the distance. He was terrified when he saw them running after him and cried out to his favorite idol, which he always wore in his hair. "Oh, my juju, Depor, what shall I do?" The juju advised him to throw a branch over his shoulder. He did that, and a huge tree began growing up from it, blocking the path of the elephants. The elephant stopped in front of the tree and started eating it. That took up some time. Then the elephants began to chase again. The young man cried out, "Oh, my juju, Depor, what shall I do?" "Throw that corn cob behind you," answered the juju. The lad did so, and the corn cob immediately grew into a vast field of maize. At this point, I'd like to mention what a juju is. Jujus are amulets and spells used in ritual practices. The juju is usually worn in the hair or on the body, but sometimes it is carried. I'm going to look around for one of those. Maybe the next time I go to one of those places where you have things that you're selling to people, and I'll find a juju on your table. Okay, so The elephants ate their way through the maze. But when they arrived on the other side, they found that the boy had already reached home. So they gave up the chase and returned to their village. The princess, however, refused to give up, saying, "I will return after I have punished this cheeky boy for stealing my tail." She turned herself into a beautiful maiden, and taking a calabash symbol in one hand, she approached the village. Everyone came out to admire this lovely girl. When the princess arrived in the village, she proclaimed that whoever succeeded in shooting an arrow into the symbol could marry her. The young men all tried and failed. An old man standing by said, "If only Kwesi, the man who cut the princess elephant's tail, were here, he would be able to hit the symbol." "Then Kwesi is the man I shall marry," the maiden said, "whether he hits the symbol or not." Kwesi was out plowing fields, and he was quickly called and told about his good fortune. But he was not at all delighted to hear about it, for he suspected that the maiden had somehow something up her sleeve. Still, he came and shot an arrow, and it struck the center of the symbol. He and the young woman were married, but all that time, she was preparing a punishment for him. The night after their marriage, the young woman turned back into an elephant while Kwesi was sleeping. She was just about to slay him when Kwesi woke up and shouted, "Oh, my Juju Deepor, save me!" The Juju turned him into a grass mat on the bed. The princess could not find him anywhere. She was deeply annoyed, and the next morning, she asked him where he had been all night. "While you were an elephant, I was the mat you were lying on," replied Kwesi. The young woman took all the mats from the bed and buried them. She burned them before she buried them. The next night, the princess turned into an elephant again and was just about to slay her husband. This time, the Juju changed him into a needle, and his wife was unable to find him. In the morning, she asked where he had been. Hearing that the Juju had helped him again, she decided to get hold of the idol and destroy it. The next day, Kwesi went to his farm to begin plowing a field. He told his wife to bring him something to eat at midday. When he finished his food, she said, "Put your head in my lap and go to sleep." Kwesi forgot that the Juju was hidden in his hair and did as she said. As soon as he was asleep, she took the Juju out of his hair, threw it into the fire that she had prepared, and Kwesi awoke to find that she had turned back into an elephant. Terrified, he cried out, "Oh, my Juju Deepor, what am I going to do?" The only answer came from out of the flames. "I am burning up, I am burning up, I am burning up." Kwesi called out for help, and the Juju replied, "Lift up your arms and pretend that you're going to fly." So Kwesi lifted his arms and turned into a hawk. And that is why the hawks are so often seen flying above the smoke from fires. They are looking for their lost Juju.
Whoa.
That's a tale from West African folk tales.
Yeah, scary story.
And I would like to add a little addendum. It's both a Pourquoi tale, telling us how something came to be, and a fairy tale. The story of Kwesi and the Elephant Princess features talking animals, the threat of being devoured, and a magical pursuit. The three sons at the beginning of the tale are familiar from the European canon of stories. Excuse me.
It's called Kwesi and the Elephant's Tail.
It doesn't mention his name in the tale. The Tale of the Princess Elephant. And it's not surprisingly, the youngest here becomes the principal figures in a tale that moves in the mode of Jack and the Beanstalk, with man-eating monsters and a protective female figure. Then modulates into a story with a supernatural helper and includes a classic fairy tale flight in which obstacles are cast in the path of the villain. So anyway, I found that to be fascinating because I had never heard of it. And I had to do some research for it. And because of that, it made me feel like I was doing a good job.
You did do a good job.
Thank you. It also added a good bit of exercise to my physical therapy treatments, just opening and closing the book.
Oh. Well, that's a good thing too.
Yes. Can I get a time check from you?
I did not time you, but...
Oh, not on my story, as on the show.
Oh, yeah, 15 minutes.
Oh, good. Thank you. Sometimes I forget to think. Or okay, I think I forget.
I like that story because it starts out as a quest story, but it quickly turns into other things.
Oh, yeah. I like it. When I first started doing storytelling and started looking at stories, I had a just not very long, but for a short while until I sat and thought about storytelling. Because I was so, I'm a science teacher, math and science teacher, and most of the activities I had been doing made sense. And I realized that in storytelling, some stories are logical and make sense, you know, like stories about Sherlock Holmes or something that all kind of, you know, figure out everything. But in some stories, there are things that don't make sense to the rational mind because they're magical and because they're mystical, because they're different and because they're fantasy. And once that sank through my skull, I stopped questioning. Because I can remember the first couple of times I read a story like that, I would go, well, wait a minute. Why would he stay married to a woman that turned into an elephant and stuff like this? and go out and work in the field the next day and then come home for supper, you know. But it doesn't matter, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do totally change gears here. Okay. And do a different aspect of African storytelling and the African diaspora. So this is my illustration, a story to illustrate the seventh Kwanzaa principle, because you know Kwanzaa's coming up next week. And the seventh principle, the last day of Kwanzaa, we will celebrate Imani, the Swahili word for faith. Other words that are sometimes used as an alternate word for faith or imani are trust, belief, conviction, assurance, confidence, deep spiritual belief. And I remembered that my Uncle Paul, proud Black man, used to send me birthday and Christmas cards before he passed that would include above his signature the words, keep the faith. And I think he would really like this story. So I'm dedicating this to my Uncle Paul. Arthur Alfonso Schomburg was another proud Black man. He was son of a Spanish-speaking Black midwife whose name was Maria Joseph. She was born in St. Croix, Virgin Islands, but she was living in Puerto Rico when she met and married Carlos Frederico Schomburg, a merchant and son of a German immigrant. Carlos Frederico was also born and raised in Puerto Rico. Arthur, or Arturo, as he was called then, their son, was born in 1874, and not very much is known about his early life. As a child, it's believed he spent time in the company of cigar workers in his hometown of Santurce in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And the story is that those cigar workers taught him the alphabet and the rudiments of reading when he was still a toddler, long before he started his formal education. There's another story that Arturo Schomburg often told about a grade school teacher telling him that Black people had no history, no heroes, no accomplishments that were worth studying. Now, Arturo, as a child, knew from his own experiences, conversations that he heard between his parents, stories he heard in the community, that that could not possibly be the full truth. But rather than argue with that teacher, he was inspired to prove him wrong and determined to find and document accomplishments of Africans in Africa and around the world. When he was still in school, he participated in an international history club with a diverse group of students in San Juan. He noticed that the white members of this group knew a lot about their family's personal history on the island, and their community accomplishments were a source of great pride to them. They were really helped with their sense of identity, where they belonged in the world. And the Black students did not have that so much. They didn't have that historic knowledge of their families necessarily. And so they didn't have that same sense of inspiration or following in the steps of their ancestors. Arturo was very young when he decided he would try to remedy what he saw as a great loss, not having that knowledge that the Black children around him and to some extent himself didn't have that history as a personal resource. And he began reading widely, searching for books by and about people of color, especially people of African descent. As a young adult, he was a political activist working for the independence of Puerto Rico and Cuba from Spain. When he graduated from the Instituto Popular, his school in San Juan, he was qualified as a certified commercial printer. And he then went to St. Thomas College on the island of St. Thomas, Danish West Indies, where he enrolled as a student of Negro history, which led to his lifetime commitment to that subject. And at that point, he became very interested in all forms of Black self-expression, and he began collecting works that came to his attention, artwork, documents, letters, manuscripts, photographs, plays, poems, sermons, even sheet music. He emigrated to New York City at the age of 17 in 1891, finding work as an elevator operator, a hotel bellhop, and a commercial printer. When he was finally hired as a mailroom supervisor, this was a good job for him, for a Brooklyn bank, he was moving up in the world. He finally had the financial and community connections to make his lifelong dream a reality. And he began searching book markets and eventually established himself as a gatherer and documentarian in book markets in the United States, in Europe, and Latin America. And once he became a little bit known in that capacity, he was hired from 1929 to 1932, he worked as curator of the Fisk University collection. They started out with 100 items in their historic archives. This is in Nashville, Tennessee, where Fisk is. And he expanded that collection to almost 5,000 items during his 3 years as curator. And that enabled him to take a job as curator to be invited to take a job as curator of the New York Public Library Harlem Division from 1932 till his death in 1938. He died young at age 64. In his honor, because of all of the documentation, all of the collections that he brought to the library, the Harlem division was renamed the Schomburg Collection in his honor, the Schomburg Collection of Negro Literature, History, and Prints, very soon after his death in 1940. But in 1972, he was honored again, long after his death, and his name attached to the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library, which still today is one of the world's most important research centers on Africa and the diaspora. So while I was researching Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, I came across things that were really surprising to me. I knew a bit about the Schomburg collection because both of my parents were interested in the collection. So we got mail from them and I saw letters going back and forth between my parents and the directors of the Schomburg collection. And I believe that some of my great grandfather's papers and possibly a couple of his canes, which T.H. Barnes, my great-grandfather, had a cane collection when he died of hundreds and hundreds of walking sticks or canes. And some of those, I believe, went to the Schomburg. And I'm still trying to find information. I need to do a lot more work to check out what, if anything, of my great-grandfather's papers and other artifacts are there. In the New York City Library Schomburg collection. But in the meantime, I also came across a book called The Life and Times of Arturo Alfonso Schomburg. He was mostly called Arthur Schomburg, Arthur A. Schomburg, by the time he was working as curator of collections. But In a lot of the writings, especially of his travels in Spain and his time on the island of Puerto Rico, he's often referred to as Arturo. And I think he probably thought of himself that way all his life. But I found this book, The Life and Times of Arturo Alfonso Schomburg, from published in 2017 by Vanessa Valdez, talking about Schomburg's mission to recover global Black history. And I knew that Schomburg had written for Crisis Magazine and many other Black journalistic publications, but I didn't know this one really fascinating story that she tells. She talks about Stromberg's mission being really three parts, that his vision was not just the amassing of documents and artifacts. He really was about historical recovery. He was interested in identifying, as well as collecting, books and many other forms of documentation to make it clear to the world the level of African scholarship, African-American scholarship, African Hispanic scholarship, that all of the research that's done all over the world by people of African descent. His second purpose was making these historic items accessible to the public and connecting them to contemporary issues and concerns. So in the pursuit of that connection, he published essays and commentary, communicated with scholars and the community, the Black community, and the more mainstream community on Black history. He was really working towards his third goal, which was envisioning an interconnected network of people of African descent all over the world. And he saw himself as instrumental in helping to bring that about. He knew he had the skills and the interest and the time to do that. So when he finally got this job as mailroom supervisor at the Brooklyn Bank. That was the start, but then he went on to be affiliated with libraries. And he traveled all over the United States and Europe and Latin America in pursuit of documents, books, manuscripts, sheet music, newspapers, periodicals, all of those items that I mentioned earlier. And he lent out these items in from his personal connection. He lent items to schools, to libraries, to conferences, and to public exhibitions. He wrote articles for Marcus Garvey's Negro World. He wrote articles for the NAACP's Crisis, which was edited by W.E.B. Du Bois. He wrote for The Messenger, which was founded by socialists, say Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen. He wrote for Opportunity, which was the publication of the National Urban League. He wrote for Harlem's newspaper, the Amsterdam News. And of course, he wrote articles for the libraries that he was affiliated with. So all of this was lots more than I knew about him when I started writing. But the story that really grabs me, that I want to be able to tell in a shortened version, because right now I just am pulling my thoughts together. In Spain, Arturo located a long-lost painting by Juan de Pareja, who was the Spanish painter born near the coastal town of Malaga. And I have been in Malaga. I went to the seaside in Malaga. I was there for about a week right about 1970, I guess. And the painter Juan de Pareja was known to have been educated as an enslaved member of the household and workshop of the contemporary Spanish painter Diego Velázquez, who kept de Pareja enslaved for 20 years. And there's a painting by de Pareja, the enslaved Black man. De Pareja's 1661 painting is The Calling of St. Matthew. He has several works that he did that are now on display at the Prado in Madrid, at the Museo del Prado in Madrid. But he didn't start out that way. There's a portrait of Juan de Parejo himself that was painted by his former owner, by the Spaniard Diego Velázquez, of the enslaved Juan de Pareja, who was owned by Velázquez at the time that the painting was completed. Velázquez painted the portrait in Rome while he was traveling with him, with this enslaved man, this workshop painter that he had in the studio. He brought that enslaved man with him to Italy in 1650. And that painting, Portrait of Juan de Pareja, is the earliest known portrait of a Spanish man of African descent who soon became a painter in his own right. So it's the first portrait anywhere of a Spanish man of African descent, but we know that he also became a painter in his own right. So this came about because in 1649, when Velázquez was court painter to Philip IV of Spain, Velázquez was sent to Rome to purchase works of art for the palace, the Alcázar in Madrid. And Velázquez brought with him the enslaved workshop painter Juan de Pareja, who served as his assistant in Velázquez's workshop. During his stay in Rome, Velázquez was asked to paint an official portrait of the Pope, of Innocent X, Pope Innocent. And Velázquez expected to have trouble with executing this painting because the Pope was a ruddy-faced man who would be painted, of course, in his bright pink and crimson robes, the robes of his office, making this a really complex study for both color and composition. And it also had to be done from life, which would force the artist to work quickly while still attempting to catch the essence of the Pope's character. in this portrait. So the portrait that he did of the enslaved man, the portrait of Juan de Pareja, was Falasquez's experiment with the challenges he had to face in doing the portrait of the Pope. To compensate for restricted color palette, Velázquez used an almost impressionistic style to impart vitality to the painting. And both paintings, the one of the enslaved man, the enslaved Black man, and the painting of the Pope, were both widely praised by other artists of the period. Of course, many people knew Velázquez's work. He was famous by that time. And the subject of that experimental painting, Juan de Pareja, was soon manumitted. He was freed by Velázquez and became a successful, independent, and self-supporting painter on his own. So as an example of the importance of the documentation and collection that was the basis of Arturo Schomburg's work, Juan de Pareja, the Afro-Spanish painter, formerly enslaved, was really more famous, internationally famous, for the 200 years following his death in 1670 than he is now in the 21st century. And Arturo Schomburg is partly responsible for bringing him back into the light. In spite of De Pareja being at the center of an exhibit at the New York Met this year, the Metropolitan Museum of Art this year, both as a painter in his own right and as the subject of Diego Velázquez's painting, that color study by Velázquez. This is a formerly enslaved man who was famous because he had a portrait done of him and because he was a painter in his own right. But nobody knows him these days. And so this exhibit at the New York Met, which built upon Arturo Schomburg's work, finding this painting and being able to display it to the community, was a really big deal. So in closing, I guess the point that I want to make about all this is that this work is important. Arthur Schomburg believed that the most important and influential work he could contribute in his lifetime was to build a library documenting the historic achievements of people of African descent in Africa and around the world. And he had faith that this library that he was helping to build would help descendants of the African diaspora have faith in ourselves as arbiters of our own lives and dreams. Something like 500,000 people visit the Center for Research in Black Culture, which is what the Schomburg Center is called now, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. 500,000 people are visiting there each year in person, and many, many more use the library long distance for digital explorations to document their own and our collective history, sharing what they learn with their families, with their communities, and the world at large. So today, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture houses more than 11 million artworks, books, documents, manuscripts, pamphlets, photographs, sound recordings that illuminate the breadth and scope of global Black arts, culture, science, and history. There are more than 17,000 digitized resources online. So if you don't know anything about the Schomburg Center or you want to know more than you do now, you should check it out. Arturo Alfonso Schomburg had faith that the truths of African history, of African greatness, would emerge. He had a vision of how to make that happen. And it is happening. We're not there yet. This work will never be complete. It will never stop. And it is faith, it's Imani that fuels our journey.
That is quite a story.
Isn't that amazing? Lots of stuff you didn't know, I didn't know.
Amazing. And the word ignorance jumped up in front of me. and it made me think about I love seeing beautiful art and things, but I will admit my ignorance, and I will not discuss art with anybody who knew what they were talking about, because I can look at something that and think, yeah, so what? And I've done that in Washington. I used to take, for 16 years, I took students to Washington for a day of seeing the, you know, Smithsonian and stuff.
And I remember some of those stories. Those are great stories.
Yeah. And I never pretended, you know, after the first couple of years, I never pretended about why the trip. Because after, I think when my third year, the principal called me and said, why are you doing this trip? What does this have to do with chemistry? And, I said, oh, can I be frank? And he said, yes. And I said, it has nothing to do with chemistry per se. It's just a day off for the kids. It's been a long year, springtime, a day away from school, a day of freedom to do something that might inspire people, see some beautiful things, some historical things, some scientific things, some beautiful paintings, maybe. And it's just a day off. And he sat there and looked, and then he smiled and he said, good for you, Mr. Z. I wish I was in a position that I could take a day off. So good for you. And he approved that, you know, and after that, I never had any trouble with those trips. But I can remember so many of the kids, and I realized it was ignorance. If you don't know why a painting is beautiful and expensive and wonderful, it may not look like anything worthwhile to you. I have stood in front of some paintings in the National Museum of Art and in a number of the museums in Washington, and I thought, yeah, I'd give you $32 for that one. And it's only because it doesn't do anything for me, and I don't appreciate the brush strokes, and I don't appreciate the shading and all that stuff, and I don't appreciate why anything painted is on a piece of canvas in a frame is worth anything more than, you know, $1,000 maybe if it's done really well. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And it doesn't mean I think I know what I'm talking about. It just means it's the value. And one of the things that I like talking to the kids in school about was, I would say, why is gold, you know, oh, it's precious. And I said, no, it's because somebody said it was. I said, if we're starving and I have a great loaf of bread that will keep us alive for 3 more days, or 1,000 pieces of gold that we can't eat and we can't carry because they're too heavy, and they're just going to stay there because we have to keep moving because they're coming after us. Which do you want? Of course, you want the bread. The gold is not important. It all depends. It's all relative. So, and that would always get me on a day when I didn't have my lesson tightly wound. I'd always had a few questions on my notebook and say, here's a thought. Which would lead to great discussions with the kids, and which I always thought was some of the best times as a teacher, because I learned a lot from the kids and they got to share ideas and express themselves instead of just sitting there and listening to me expound on what I supposedly knew. So art and ignorance, that'd be a good title for something. You know, a book or that, because I've never understood the whatever that famous painting is by Leonardo da Vinci, you know, in the Louvre and all that stuff, and why people would pay money and why people would insure it, stuff like that. Just crazy. Just recently, I've been reading about a painting that was bought at a sale for $2 and turned out to be worth millions.
Can you imagine having a home that you wanted to have the ceiling painted? and you wanted something not Michelangelo's necessarily painting on the ceiling,
right,
but something that would be beautiful to you. Can you imagine wanting that?
Yeah, except that I would not pay anybody to paint it. I would get a photographer to take a great picture or find a great picture and then find some company that would reproduce it so I could put it up as wallpaper.
And that could easily cost several thousand dollars, $5,000.
Yeah, I guess.
Would that be worth it?
Maybe for an individual. I wouldn't do it. You know, I wouldn't do it because it's so individual and it would be so selfish in a sense. I would think I could spend that money on something else that would be, you know, beneficial to other people only because of, you know, something like that. But I do understand if somebody has the money and that would make them happy, then that's fine. Because I, you know, people can do what they want. And I don't say that you shouldn't value art, you know. It's just it really has never made sense to me that someone could, you know, will wait for hours and hours and hours in line to stand in front of a painting and then go, oh my goodness, isn't that just a big deal? You know?
Is there anything you would stand for hour? You would wait hours and stand in line for hours and hours for?
Something that I could admire. I would love to see. I would love to see the David statue by Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would love to be able to, and the Pietà, you know, statue made out of a single piece of marble of a mother with the body, only because of a little bit of experience with trying to carve and make things. You know, I've made some things out of wood that I'm very proud of and are no way worth anything but my own, whatever I feel like, you know. And I understand how hard it is to make something out of a block of wood. And I've made some things.
That doesn't carry over to empathy for people who would do that for paintings.
Oh, it carries over that the painting is considered worthwhile and worth lots of money, but not millions. David, the statue, Michelangelo's statue of David, I don't think that's worth millions of dollars. Somebody does, but I don't. I mean, it's just it's a great feat. But
the fact that it's old, it doesn't make a difference.
Only in a sense that I know people value things that are old. I own some things that are old and I value them greatly, but you know, they're just things. And in the scheme of things, they're just atoms that are gonna go away.
So, like us. So maybe it's just that some people have too much money.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I guess if I was wealthy, I would have art. But I have art, you know. I'll give you an example. I found once in a shop someplace, you know, place where you could go and they have all kind of antiques and things. I once stumbled in the corner of this place. It had 25 rooms probably. And my wife was a harpist. And I found this picture. And I thought it was a painting on canvas. It's not. It's on some kind of hard paper. And it was slightly damaged. But it is a beautiful picture of a harpist with someone standing behind her. And I don't know if it's a teacher or a friend. It's some probably in this 18th century, maybe 19th, probably 18th century. Looks like it might be a French place. The two women are in really nice like gowns. And the woman is sitting at the harp. And when I found that, I thought, oh my goodness, I won't be able to afford that. I wound up buying it, and it only cost, I believe it cost me $45. And in fact, it had a bigger price tag on it, but the woman said, that's been there for so long that $45 and it's yours. And I bought it because of my wife. Right. And I love it. It's hanging in our bedroom.
Right.
And we've had it for 20 some years. I even once took it to a person I knew who did some art, who did painting and stuff, and asked if she could. There are two places in it that were sort of a little bit of damage. And I thought, I said, do you think that, could this be repaired? Is it worth doing that? And she said, no, it's not worth doing that. And she explained to me it's on, you know, it's really heavy paper and it's the nice frame and everything. She said, but she said, you could probably do that yourself, get some watercolor and, you know, mix up colors and try to match the color. And because it was just a little bit of shading needed to be done. And I've never done it. But she explained to me, she said, you know, you don't want to spend money on fixing this. It's probably worth $30.
Okay. Well, here's an unrelated question. Do you want to do a 7-minute story to close?
I got a 7-minute story. I do.
All right. Then you're okay. Up.
Yeah. Okay. Here we are.
That was very interesting, though. Thank you, Franz.
Okay. Oh, thanks. And I, you know, and no way do I think I'm right. It's a matter, and I admit it's a matter of ignorance. It's like knowing what a jewel is worth, you know.
Okay.
I think my background in chemistry is hampering my brain, but that's okay. All right, so here we go. I picked this out because I thought it would give you a laugh. This title is Talks Too Much. No smile. Okay.
Yes. I'm smiling.
Okay, here you go. Man going along found a skeleton of a man's head. Old head, how come you here? Mouth brought me here. Mouth's going to bring you here. He goes up to the town and telling about the old head. A great crowd of people went with him down there. They called on this head to talk to them. The head never said nothing. They fell on this feller and beat him. The old head turned and said, didn't I tell you Mouth was going to bring you here? Okay. So... This is the second version coming up. In slavery's time, the colored man traveling on came to where there was a terrapin. The terrapin spoke to him and said, one day you shall be free. He done him so much good, he just couldn't keep it. Goes up to his master's house and says, a terrapin spoke to me this morning. And his master said, what did he say? One day you shall be free. I'm going down here, and this terrapin don't talk to me. I'm going to whip you to death. So he called upon the terrapin, and he went back in the house. He commenced whipping the colored fellow. He near whipped him to death, so the old terrapin raised up on his legs and said, it's bad to talk too much. Oh, boy.
Okay. That's the Shaggy Dog story.
Yeah, and you know why I like that too much? I mean, so much. Because I've been accused of talking too much. I hope nobody's going to beat me to death for it. But
well, just listening to you enjoy that story was worth the telling.
Oh, good. I'm glad. So, you know, it is amazing. I guess I'm just a fatalist, you know. We're here for such a short time on this planet, and we ain't going no place else, in my opinion, in my beliefs. And so things are not worthwhile. There is nothing that I treasure more than friendship, my wife, who I love dearly, my children, who I'm proud of, and, you know, and people I meet and friends, because that's all that counts, you know. Just recently, I was looking through collections I have, my college ring, my high school ring. I have a small diamond ring. I don't know where I got it. It looks like it was either an engagement ring or something. And I remember years ago, I took it to a jeweler and said, can you tell me if this is worth anything? The guy said, yeah, it's probably worth a couple hundred dollars. So that's a nice, it's a small stone, but it's nice. And, you know, and he said, do you want to sell it? And I said, no. I said, I don't even know how I got it. And I can't remember. I think I found it, but I can remember searching to see, you know, if it belonged to anybody. But anyway, but it doesn't mean anything. It's been in that box for years. My high school ring, I haven't worn that for 40 years. My college ring, I haven't worn that for even longer, probably. And I was so proud of them as a young person. And my father couldn't believe he spent money on the first one, $32 for my high school ring back in 1956. And then $54, I think, for my college ring in the 60s. And they're not worth anything, really. You know, they're just things. They've been laying in that box for years and years and years and years. And now I'm deciding about which grandchild I should give them to. You know, and maybe they'll like that, you know, the old man's rings. Hey, who knows? But it's just not important, really. You know, I have a sword from my grandfather I gave to my grandson. He hasn't done anything with it. My daughter is saving it for when he's a teenager, so he might appreciate it, because it's 100 years old, and it's nice, and, you know, it has some history to it. But it's just an object. Nothing is as important. Objects can't be as important as anything else. People are more important than any objects.
I agree with that.
Yes. And absolutely, I'm preaching to the choir, I think. Because just getting to know you over the years, I believe you have some similar feelings. Uh-oh, be careful. I almost said that you and I might have some feelings alike. But I think that's why we get along. We do share some serious feelings about things.
Impatience and exasperation.
Arrogance and impatience. How's that?
I can certainly admit to some arrogance.
No, you're not arrogant. You're impatient, but you're not arrogant.
Ah.
I think that would be the title for us as a duo. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen. Arrogance and impatience. Wait a minute. Maybe it should be impatience and alphabetically it works, arrogance and impatience.
Well, I think it's time for us to close the show. I can't find my cheat sheet, so I'm just going to talk from memory.
There you go.
Saying thank you for all of our listeners for listening, for turning us on. And I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Olkowski.
And we're closing out the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland, and reminding our listeners that we want them to share stories and tell stories and listen to stories in order to be better human beings.
Yes.
And John Case is going to tell us what's up next.
Well, today is